This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. One of the largest annual gatherings of U.S. radio amateur operators takes place this weekend, and La Crosse area ham radio enthusiasts will be among them. The American Radio Relay League, or ARRL, sponsors the two-day event that brings some 35,000 operators together, mostly by way of radio waves, from locations all over North America. As we learned in this interview first aired in 2014, the annual field day exercise has several goals rolled into it. It's a social opportunity for ham radio operators to work together. It's a way for local clubs to demonstrate the often under-recognized community service they provide to the area. And it's an occasion for the public to learn about and even use ham radio. To the average listener, the dits and dahs and bleeps heard on shortwave radios or scanners are not very discernible, even obnoxious at times. Voice broadcasts are better, but even those can be challenging. And many of them can be attributed to amateur radio. Not because these broadcasters don't know what they're doing, rather it's because they do know what they're doing, which can include pushing technology to new heights. Over the past 100 years, radio hobbyists have taken what was wired telegraphy in the late 1800s and developed it into short and long-range wireless communications, a technology that most of us take for granted today in the wireless digital world we live in. The number of licensed amateur radio operators worldwide continues to grow, quickly approaching 1 million in the U.S. alone. Commonly referred to as hams, the interests of these radio operators have expanded into television, digital data and voice communications, educational programs for schools, and community service. This weekend's ARRL Field Day is the single most popular on-the-air event held annually in the U.S. and Canada. While those with a competitive spirit treat it as a contest, others use the occasion to practice their emergency response capabilities, to learn to operate radio gear in less than optimal conditions, and in some cases to demonstrate how they can help with parades, bike-a-thons, and other local events. According to the ARRL, ham operators range in age from youngsters to grandparents, including rocket scientists and rock stars, but most are your average down-the-block friends and neighbors, and I'll admit to being one of them, as are my guests today, including a couple representatives from one of Western Wisconsin's local radio clubs. Greg Miller is president of the Riverland Amateur Radio Club, and Dan Epps is chairing the club's field day events this weekend. Also with us is Todd Shea, the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in La Crosse. He coordinates the local Skywarn program, which utilizes local radio amateurs as spotters during severe weather events. He's also an amateur operator in his own right. So welcome, all of you. Let's start with the basics. Greg, tell us a little bit about just what amateur radio is all about, a little bit of its history, why it exists.
Well, amateur radio is, it's kind of an individual event. I mean, people like to play with radios going back to when they were a little kid. You know, they throw a wire up in a tree. They make contact with a friend down the block or somebody across town. That's kind of developed into experimentation by these individuals. They build these radios and put up these antennas, and it's an excitement. So, yeah, that still goes on today as it did back then.
Well, in 100 years ago, there weren't any options. You had to build your own equipment. That's not the same today, though, is it?
No, you can buy your own equipment, but you can also still make your own equipment if you want. Yeah, although crude by today's standards, but you can still do that.
Today's amateur operators, or ham operators, and I guess we'll use them interchangeably, the handle of ham operators, some conjecture taking it back to the days of telegraphy, differentiating between a professional code sender and somebody who was kind of playing with it on the radio. But I'm not sure.
You know, that's been talked about quite a bit. In fact, I've even seen that in different ham radio magazines as to where that name came about. I'm not sure if anybody really knows, and there are several different ideas as to where it came from.
Dan, tell me a little bit about, from your perspective, too.
There are a number of different modes, you know, like Morse code, or they call it CW. And phone, of course, is talking with your voice. But there's a lot of digital modes now, too. Some of the older ones were like radio teletype. But now there's dozens of different modes where you connect a computer to your radio and you communicate with other stations using some sort of digital modes to send and things like that. Mm-hmm. But also people bounce signals off the moon or use satellites to talk with people or the International Space Station. So it's pretty interesting. I guess one of the things I've always liked about it was that, you know, you can give a call and someone will come back to you from some other country or you'll hear somebody calling and you'll be able to tell from their call sign that they're from Australia or something. And it's just a thrill to be able to try to call them back and have them hear you on the other side of the world. And
so for the uninitiated, people who don't understand what this amateur radio is all about, I mean, kind of physically what it is or how it works, many people are familiar with CB radio, I suspect. Mm-hmm. How does that compare?
Well, it's very much like CB radio in the fact that, you know, you have a radio and some feed line and an outdoor antenna.
And a microphone.
And a microphone and all of that. The difference with being a ham is that your license allows you to operate on many different bands rather than just one. So, you know, when conditions aren't good on one band, typically they're good on a different band.
So. Okay, we got to stop now. We're talking about bands and conditions. Greg, can you say a little bit more about what we're talking about here?
The different bands. When you're talking the different frequencies, like we might be able to operate within the 7 megahertz band, a certain segment. They're just named a little bit different.
Like regular radio, television?
Yeah, I mean, think maybe a good way to explain it is like FM radio is the FM band going from 88 megahertz up to
108 is where FM is.
Yeah, 108. Mm-hmm. That's one band, that's FM band. And AM radio, you know, is below that. It's like 570 kilohertz, which mm-hmm. is be like 0.57 megahertz.
What I hear you saying is that we're
looking
at
two different bands.
We're looking at a full spectrum. We're looking at AM radio as being very low frequency, FM radio being up there higher frequency, and then there's these ham radio bands that are kind of sandwiched in between and beyond. And some of those
right.
we're talking about are in what we might conventionally think of as shortwave radio.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, a good way to describe it, ham radio is you're talking to shortwave radio, and a lot of people listen to the shortwave radios. The difference is within our radios is the transmitter. So we're able to transmit a signal out on the same frequency that you would be listening to. And just to kind of clarify the difference between amateur radio and CB radios, mm-hmm. CB radios are, it's not required to have a license. And it's not as heavily regulated as amateur radio is. But we are a licensed organization, licensed through the FCC as individuals.
Mm-hmm. And what does that require?
That requires taking a test for each of the technician license, general or extra.
And what's on the test? What things are we studying for?
You're studying, one, the FCC rules and regulations. They're pretty heavy mm-hmm. in that, of course. Mm-hmm. And radio theory, electronics. So there's quite a bit that you have to study, and then you're throwing this 50-question test, which could be anything that you studied within that book.
Greg Miller is president of the Riverland Amateur Radio Club, and fellow club member Dan Epps is here as well. We're talking a little bit about amateur radio in conjunction with this weekend's Field Day operations, where you too can take in some of what this is all about, and we'll get on to that in just a moment. I just wanted to follow up, Greg, on one of the things that you commented regarding the tests, and do you have to be a physics major in order to really understand all of this, to be able to get involved? I mean, I thought this was kind of a family-friendly thing, this amateur radio bit.
No, really, all you really have to do is have that desire. You want to get that ham license. That'll push you to study.
So, and the electronics and what have you that you need to learn along the way, you just do.
For some people, I suppose that can be a little tough. It was a little tough for me to begin with, even coming from a home where my dad was an electrician his whole life, but that entry level, the technician, that one is fairly easy to get into. And while you're in that technician, you'll learn more as you go on.
So, Dan, if we went to your house right now and sat down in yours or a typical amateur radio ham shack, what would we see?
I don't know if I'm a good one to answer that question because I've been licensed, well, about 20 years, but in that time they've come out with radios that will do just about anything you want to do in one radio. So I only have one main radio plus another mobile radio so that I can, you know, listen to two things at once. And then, of course, I have a power supply and an antenna tuner. So a few things like that. But most hams have much more equipment. Looks like a wall of things.
Lots of radio equipment.
So,
Greg, what do you have?
Well, I have a wall.
You have a wall's worth.
Yeah, mine's a combination of my collection over the years as well as my father's who's passed away.
Oh.
So I have four complete stations set up and a lot of collectibles over the years. So there's one main radio I use in the shack. Another one is out in my camper. Of course, I use that when I camp.
Okay, so you've made reference to a camper, and Dan, you mentioned a mobile unit. So these, obviously, this is radio equipment that you can take on the go.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, I guess the mobile unit would be the type of radio that you would have, you know, in your car or truck, so that you can talk to people, you know, going down the road. Or if you live in an area that doesn't allow antennas, some of the, you know, newer communities have covenants that don't allow them. You can still have something that you put up on your car or put up temporarily and still be able to get on the air.
Let's talk about Field Day then specifically. That's going on this weekend. It's a two-day event. Amateur radio operators around the country, and in fact, I suspect maybe in other parts of the world will get involved in this as well. But Dan, you're chairing the event for the Riverland Club. Amateur operators get together locally. You go someplace out of the norm and set up equipment in a remote area and broadcast from there?
Well, like you mentioned, the object of it is to actually go out in a field somewhere.
Literally.
Or at least someplace where they're less than optimal conditions and learn to operate in those conditions, or part of it too is just to, you know, make sure the equipment that you have still works and that you can set it up in case it's needed in emergency or whatever. And the other part of it too is just to, you know, acquaint the general public with amateur radio. So we'll be setting up Saturday morning, and we'll be operating Saturdays starting at 1 p.m. through the day and night around the clock until 1 p.m. Sunday. The object is to try to contact as many people as you can around the country. And, well, we always contact some, too, outside the country in Canada and Mexico and South America and sometimes overseas as well. And they like you to set up in a public location to encourage the general public to come and see what you're doing and talk.
Are there, in fact, then opportunities with this setting for the public to talk on a radio?
Yes, that's a very good point, because as long as someone is there who has a license, they can let someone else use the radio and talk and make contacts with people. So
wherever they might be.
Right. So,
Greg, you're hosting this out at your place. Tell us, well, certainly we want to know where this is so that we can stop in if we'd like to this weekend. But what's unique about where you are out in the field, as it were?
Yeah, I'm north of Holman.
Okay.
5 miles north of Holman on Highway 53, just past what's Whispering Pines Campground. You turn left right after that campground. It's A. Johnson Road. It kind of S-curves down in there. Of course, right up on the road, we'll have a big sign that, you know, a special event station taking place, and another one at the entrance to my driveway. There'll be some campers back there, and feel free to just drive back and walk back and stop anybody and say, hey, you know, what's going on? We'll
be
there.
So you're setting up tents and what have you for all of the equipment?
We have an emergency trailer that we'll have probably a couple radios operating out of that.
So it's like one of these communications trailers that we might see in news coverage from emergency places, that type of thing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the reason we do that, imagine like tornadoes and whatnot, and we have to exhibit that we are capable of going into these areas, setting up a portable station, and giving emergency communications to whoever might need it, the police, fire, whoever. And we have exhibited that in all these disasters over the years. And part of it is because this one weekend a year that we practice this.
Well, let's use that as a jumping off point, and let's bring Todd Shea into the conversation, who's been patiently sitting by here and taking this in. Todd, in your role with the National Weather Service, you count on these guys, specifically with the Skywarn program. Tell us about all of that.
Yeah, we do. As they were describing the hobby and the activity, I was thinking to myself that the reason I always had interest in it is because you can just do it as a hobby and have the interest of talking to people around the world and that sort of aspect. But it also has this, you can help your community aspect. Not only with special events going on, but things like what we use it for at the National Weather Service, which is help us with storm spotting, storm spotter reports, and overall communication. And storm spotters and storm spotting report is key in making our warnings more accurate, along with our radar information. And the amateur radio component of that storm spotter group is huge compared to just like with all our volunteer firemen and stuff. So. We heavily rely on folks like Dan and Greg and other amateur radio operators, not only in the La Crosse area but around the region, mm-hmm. to pass along important, timely, severe weather reports so that we can use them in the warning process. So
that's a basis to a lot of the information that you're getting is coming from the field, if you will.
It is, yeah.
From these guys.
And that's they talked about how Field Day is kind of demonstrates that. But in some ways, we use that every time during severe weather season, and any time there's some severe weather in the area, we're talking to people kind of out in the field, because one of the other nice components of amateur radio is the mobility of it.
Sure.
And being able to talk to people that are visually looking at the storm, and they're giving us descriptions of what they're seeing. We look at what we see on radar, and we can put out a warning with a lot more confidence because mm-hmm. we're getting that real-time information. So we really appreciate I said heavily rely on the assistance of amateur radio operators.
Now, just because you're an amateur radio operator doesn't necessarily make you a good weather observer. I mean, you may not know anything about meteorology and still be a radio amateur. So you must add something to this mix with training and programs like that related to Skywarn?
We do. We try to connect with the different clubs in the area, and we also hold storm spotter training, not just for the amateur radio community, but for all our potential storm spotters. But then we rely on leaders in the amateur radio clubs and groups also as kind of liaisons, and the emergency coordinators in each county too that kind of keep everyone on the same page. And we discuss how we want to work storm spotting mm-hmm. into the activities and such. So there's a lot of different groups that try to come together to make each severe weather season as safe as we can.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Todd Shea is the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service here in La Crosse. Also in the studio with us today is the president of the Riverland Amateur Radio Club, Greg Miller, and another member of the club, Dan Epps, who's also chairing this weekend's field day activities for the Riverland Amateur Radio Club. Todd, you're working with more than just the local lacrosse clubs, because the National Weather Service has a large region that you're responsible for. How do you coordinate local Skywarn and amateur radio operators with those that are in, I don't know, Rochester or Lansing, Iowa, or wherever they might be? There must be some radio communications coordination that has to go on with all of that.
Yeah. There's about 13 different clubs that just my office works with, and that's just a small nucleus, of course, nationally. But we coordinate, especially in the spring with the spotter training season. I myself try to keep in touch with a lot of the groups. We have meetings or our own local hosted seminars every couple years. And then we also have a event that we run in early December, where we invite amateur radio operators from all around the region to just come visit our station for the day and allow us to show our appreciation for their efforts and stuff. So,
I was going to ask Greg or Dan, have either of you worked with Skywarn, been spotters, been out there participating in those kind of network operations?
Oh, yeah.
And what's that like?
I remember once sitting up on the hill over by Nodine and thought my truck was going to tip right over the hill because the wind came up and grabbed me. I learned to be a little safer with where I parked after that.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with being down at the boat landing by Stoddard. That was a time when we had a bunch of straight line winds, I guess, and went down County K. And just getting home from there was difficult because there were so many trees down across the highway. And
is it just that you're, Todd, just relying on these types of reports during what we think of as severe weather now, during the summer, tornadoes, severe thunderstorms, that type of thing? Or do you take reports in during, I don't know, winter severe weather, things like that? I mean, how does that support what you're trying to do, too?
Yeah, we will any time of year. It's not as often, but there'll be times when there might be an icing event or a quick snow burst that hits a community. And sometimes we will get on the radios that we have at our office and try to reach out to the communities via amateur radio and just see, you know, who's out there and what they're experiencing. So,
and we live
just
in
another facet of how the communication is so important.
As you say, we live in a flood-prone area too. So
yeah, when we expect weather in the area, we try to make an effort to check in and see who's out there, because if people like Greg or Dan and others in the area that are volunteering their time, we certainly want to take their information if we have someone available. So,
beyond anticipating severe weather and what have you, amateur radio clubs can be very handy at the rescue, if you will, after an event, after a tornado or after a severe storm comes through, by providing emergency communications. Is that primarily the role that amateurs would play, Greg?
That's correct. I remember the Stockton flood. It's going back a ways now, but they lost quite a few homes and so forth, and communications was down for quite a while there. And we had our communications trailer over there for about a week and a half. And people were relying on us to get communications out of the Stockton area, whether it be for an emergency or just somebody wanting to get word to a relative that they were fine. So, I mean, that was about a week and a half that they continued to do that.
And I've also been up at damage surveys after larger size tornadoes and, overhear traffic on amateur radio side of, like Greg said, all kinds of relay of where emergency equipment needs to go, but a lot of information being passed on to emergency management officials and just coordination, because there is no other communication really out there to so that everyone's talking on the same page. So I've seen it work.
And sometimes we assist other organizations such as the Red Cross or the Salvation Army if we're not needed for, you know, other sorts of communications. There's organizations like that that like to have us help them out, and, you know, we'll put somebody right at their location, and then we'll have people out in cars, you know, checking on supplies or things that are needed at other locations as well.
In this day and age of continuous communications on all fronts, cell phones especially come to mind. Why do we need amateur radio to replace that?
Well, cell phones require a cell tower, and they can go down, whether it's physically go down or by overuse. You take the Boston bombing. Too many people were using their cell phones, and it timed out. So there was no communication by your cell phone at that time. Amateur radio operators were called into service right then and there. I mean, the telephones can go down.
And in part, that's because in that instance, there were amateur radio operators there or assisting with the race itself. And that leads us into another part of, I guess, what this is all about. For instance, the Riverland Amateur Radio Club, you help provide communications for other kind of community events as well, not just emergencies. Tell us a little bit about those things, because I know that you help communications for parades or bike marathons.
What our function is to make sure that anything that happens along the route that needs attention, as an example, we had one lady fall down and couldn't continue or walk. Well, we have a spotter car come around and pick her up and get her back to the safe spot. Or if anybody else falls down or anything and needs attention.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had instances where a rider has gone down and needed medical attention. We relay that back. We get somebody out there to help them as soon as possible.
I actually had runners come up to me. I was wearing, you know, one of the green vests, and I had a radio, so they knew I was a volunteer. And I actually had some people run out of their way to come up to me and shake my hand and thank me for doing that. So a heartwarming thing, too, to know that they appreciated us. And some of them said, well, without you guys, we wouldn't be able to have this event. So,
in this day and age of cell phones and the internet, all of the technical interconnections that everybody has, who is still typically interested in this type of radio communications activity, this radio thing and walkie-talkies or portable car radios and things like that?
Who's interested? I mean,
who's doing it? Yeah,
it's a variation across all age groups and all types of people. You can see that just in our club meetings. The age that we have in there, you know, the teens all the way up to 90 years old. It's a varied group. And, you know,
it's not just guys either, not all the time.
No, it's gals too.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about the cell phones. How many times have you picked up a cell phone and just dialed in a number and said, what the heck, I'm going to talk to this person? So you really don't do that. You get on ham radio and talk to people around the world. You just don't do that with a cell phone. Amateur radio, you can make friends all the way around the world.
Well, the best of luck this weekend. Field day, rain or shine?
Yes. If it's lightning, we may have to cease operation for a while.
And again, people are welcome to come out Saturday morning while you're setting up and right on through Saturday evening.
Right.
You said overnight?
Yeah, we'll be there
24 hours a day through midday on Sunday.
Right. We'll have probably four or five different stations set up with different antennas, from tall vertical antennas to well, one guy likes to bring his antenna that he makes out of two slinkies. And I'm going to have
that's fairly innovative.
A long wire antenna strung up that's like 107 feet long. And that'll be fun to play with, too.
And again, field day is an opportunity for anybody to come and experience some of these things, see what's going on with the experimenting, maybe have a chance to talk on the radio, talk across the county or talk across the country, as the case may be. The last thing I'd like to touch on very briefly is that Field Day is sponsored by the American Radio Relay League, the ARRL. We've made reference to the organization. Greg, tell us a little bit more about what this organization is all about.
ARRL has been around for 100 years. Back then, the radio was coming about, and they felt that there should be an organization to represent them, because a lot of regulations were starting to come along. And part of the reason why we're still here is we do a lot of experimenting. The FCC encourages that because amateur radio operators come up with things that can be, you know, can grow on. Mm-hmm. Example, I don't text, but when I think about it, I used to text when Packet Radio came out.
That's
sitting in front of your keyboard on your computer and typing a letter to somebody, hitting go, and it sends it to another computer.
And doing that on amateur radio years ago.
Uh-huh. But ever since back then, I mean, the ARRL has stayed strong.
Mm-hmm.
They represent the amateur radio community in front of Congress or whoever that's passing laws that they feel would benefit the community as well as amateur radio. So they're an organization that fights for us for what amateur radio should have.
Greg Miller is president of the Riverland Amateur Radio Club. Club member Dan Epps is coordinating this weekend's field day operations, and Todd Shea is the warning coordination meteorologist with the La Crosse Office of the National Weather Service. Thanks to all of you. This weekend's field day gathering near Holman by the Riverland Amateur Radio Club is just one of three in the immediate area. Events are also being held by the Mississippi Valley Amateur Radio Association in Onalaska and the Winona Amateur Radio Club. They'll be meeting just outside of Winona. Links to directions and details for these and other ARRL Field Day activities can be found on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers, where you'll also find audio archives of today's show. Coming up, my colleague Maureen McCollum revisits an interview aired earlier this year about a UWL student project underway to uncover community history that will inspire a pump house art exhibit that calls attention to the stories behind these historical artifacts. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto.
From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Art can provide a snapshot into history. We can learn so much about our past when we study the paintings or sculptures of a particular era. But what happens when you bring history and art together now? Through a new project called Artifact, organizers are seeking artists to create pieces inspired by local historical objects. Here today to talk about Artifact are Ariel Bougeau. She's a UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of History and co-director of Artifact. Ariel Raker is also co-director, and she's a PR manager for the project. And Callie O'Connor is the curator. And both Callie and Ariel, the second Ariel there, are UW-La Crosse students. So Ariel Bougeau, I'm wondering if you can first just explain what exactly Artifact is.
What is Artifact?
What is Artifact?
It's an exhibit that will go on at the Pump House Regional Art Center in February and March.
Of 2016. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And what it is we're choosing 15 local artifacts, so things like cigar boxes, because there was a big cigar manufacturing industry here. The Leona, which is a woman's undergarment. We have a dress that Kelly's studying.
Yeah. We have a dress that was sold at Newberg's in La Crosse, which is actually a men's clothing store, but they had some women's clothing there for a while. Mm-hmm. And a wedding dress designed by a woman in 1914. And actually the Leona, that's a patented undergarment that was designed by this woman, and she sold it all over the world, I believe.
Mm-hmm. But she started here in La Crosse?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, how neat.
Mm-hmm.
Just on Main Street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
You can visit her house as an antique shop now.
Okay.
We have two patented products. The other one is a
Paper fastener,
that's it.
That was also developed here in La Crosse.
Yep.
It's from the Bump Pump Company, which was located in La Crosse. And it's a paper fastener that doesn't use staples, but it works as, it looks like an industrial stapler, but it just kind of puts it all together without using any metal.
Huh.
Right.
So all these objects are things that you all found through the La Crosse Historical Society. Mm-hmm. Ariel, do you want to maybe talk about that partnership and how you all chose the different objects to include in this project?
Of course. So this project actually started as a graded class project in the Intro to Public and Policy History class taught by Dr. Ariel Bougeau in the fall of 2013. And it was a group project. My group members were Mathis Yama, who was a German foreign exchange student and is now back in Germany, and Amanda Drummond, who was graduating that semester and has since, I believe, moved on to graduate school. And Amanda had been interning at the La Crosse County Historical Society for several semesters at this point. And because the main stipulation of the assignment was to partner with a local organization and create a public history project for them. And so we figured let's capitalize on this relationship that's already been established. Peggy and Amanda knew each other very well. And so we went down to the collections and we're peeking through. And at first we're like, oh, let's do like a traveling exhibit on typewriters or like cameras, cause they had a lot of those. But, Peggy said, look, we have a lot of objects that were made in La Crosse. I've always wanted to do something with it. You know, how can we, let's do something with that. And then talking with Dr. Ariel Bougeau, we decided, okay, but let's make it a little bit more interesting. Let's add something to it, like try like art or something. And just through kind of talking and then talking with the Pump House Regional Art Center, you know, what have you done before? What's worked? What's not? We really kind of all together developed this collaboration, I should say, between art and history, two local organizations, local artists, local businesses, I refer to it as the Holy Trinity.
And Callie, was it hard to narrow down each of the objects, these 15 objects?
It was really interesting. I actually researched five of them specifically. We actually found out one of them was not made in La Crosse, but it's so incredible. You just go from the little bit of information we have on them and it's like a scavenger hunt. You find one thing after another after another. And it was super interesting. There are some things that we have as parameters. We don't want too many textile objects. We don't want too many of a certain type of object. But our only big parameter is that it has to be made in La Crosse. And it's been really fun looking through them and researching them.
But yeah, as you said, it's textiles. It's the cigar boxes, Ariel, that you mentioned before.
We're looking for some artifacts that represent our Ho-Chunk community and our Hmong community as well. So we have a third student that's working on this project, a diversity coordinator and education manager. And so she's trying to find artifacts made in La Crosse that will represent those communities as well.
Yeah, I would also like to add, too, just Kelly, Nimi, and I are in a grant writing class where we're writing one of the grants for the project, and we were looking at some of the census data to try and work with needs assessment and justification. And in looking at the census data, Asian populations make up 4.9% of La Crosse. It's the second highest population, so that's definitely one of our serious goals, is to really represent the diversity that does live in La Crosse.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about Artifact, a new project that blends history and art. My guests are Ariel Raker. She's the co-director and PR manager for Artifact. Callie O'Connor is the curator, and both of them are UW-La Crosse students. And Ariel Bougeot, she's a UW-La Crosse assistant professor of history and co-director of Artifact. So you've picked out your objects. Or I guess you're still hunting for some. But essentially, right now, you have a call out to artists to interpret these artifacts in their own way. Ariel, can you explain that process and what exactly you all are looking for?
Right. So we have a website. It's art-effect.org.
And we'll have a link on our website.
Right. That's great. So on the website, what you will see is that on September 15th, there will be... is the end of our call to artists. You will be asked to give an example of five works of art, and then there will be the blind jury that works with the pump house. They will choose the 15 artists, and really we're looking for any sort of art other than performance art. So they'll choose a diversity of artists. They will put the artifact with the artist and then allow the artist time to go. We'll give them 3 months to create a piece of art that represents the artifact in some way.
Wow. And the students get to choose which artist gets which artifact.
No, it's not the students. Okay. It will be the jurors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so actually this part is out of our hands. It's sure. The jurors of the pump house that will do that work. So what the students will do, so eventually what I'm going to do is teach a class on this. So starting in September until...
the project
May?
Ends?
Or? May, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll be teaching a class where the students will do a material culture analysis of each object.
What
which
does
is,
that mean?
Yeah, so I'm actually a material culturalist.
Oh.
So I'll teach the students my craft, which is studying an object for what it can tell you about the history of the place that made it or the people that made it, right?
Based on the materials?
Yeah. Well, it's all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So things have markers on them.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll be able to see the manufacturer sometimes. And then sometimes materials will tell you something, right? Rayon only comes at a certain time. The color mauve only comes at a certain mm-hmm. time, right? So there's the history of those of color. There's a history of fabric. There's a history of manufacture and how that changes over time. And then there's a company that created it that you can research. And then really my book, which is called Victorian Fashion Accessories, that looks at objects and what they can tell us about Victorian culture, right? So what can a fan tell us about flirting in Victorian Britain? Mm-hmm. What can gloves tell us about how women wanted to represent their hands that worked all day, but they weren't supposed to be working, right? How does that help them represent themselves as a true woman, right? So each of our artifacts will tell us something about, you know, why is a cigar box square?
other, you know, when you consider that cigars are, they're long and thin, but they're round, right? So why is it square? So often you can see from an artifact a connection to other artifacts, right? Our culture is square, right? Our culture is linear. It's not circular, right? Unlike what we might say about the Ho-Chunk Nation culture, right? And circularness is very important to that culture. So it represents the culture. The things that we will look at will represent the culture in various ways. And I don't know which ways because my students haven't done the work yet.
Well, it's so amazing that, I mean, this is a public art project, I guess, at its core, but just the educational element that comes about from all of this. What is that like for you, Callie?
Oh, I think this exhibit is super exciting to people who don't learn history in the traditional ways. History is one of those subjects like math that only certain people can excel at, at least only certain people seem to excel at. And I think if it's taught in different ways, that's like the best way to reach other audiences. And with museum, specifically history museum exhibits, that's always a hard push, is to try to get those different audiences. And I think with the art aspect of that, that we're really solving that problem.
Ariel, did you want to add on?
Yeah, that's also something that we're really, Callie, Nimi, and I are working really hard on. One of our goals in our mission statement is for the educational aspect of this. And one of the things we're really looking to do is hopefully get local schools as well part of this. And so we've been doing a lot of research on arts integration and how important that is. And just a few of the snippets that we found so far is that arts integration provides better retention of knowledge. So, you know, there was a study that was done that looked at, so they were teaching history, and so they interviewed the kids right before, right after, and 2 months later. Right before, they were all at the same level. Right after, they were all at the same level. But 2 months on, the kids who'd gone through the arts integration curriculum remembered so much more than the kids who had not. So really, kind of one of the bigger goals of this project to include the students is to provide them opportunities to learn history in a different way, especially local history. It's important to know where you're from and to know why the place you're from is the way it is. And that can really be important to provide, to be a better citizen, to be a better just member of society. So providing opportunities like that to hopefully increase interest as well is really what we're trying to do.
It is interesting how this can really teach so many more people just about our local history. Like, I had no idea that a certain type of pin was invented in La Crosse, however long ago it was. And, you know, so just with one exhibit, you could learn so much, and how that just spills over into what else was going on in La Crosse at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ariel?
Oh, the other thing I'd like to add, too, is the other thing that I love about our project is that it, you know, you can go through as just an art person and enjoy the art, or you can go through it just as a history person and enjoy it. So I don't think you have to be just a history or just an art. I think anybody can go through and really glean something from it as well.
So when it comes to once the artists are selected and they're assigned a specific artifact, I'm assuming it's up to them to do what they want with the work of art they create.
So what we do is we, as students, we'll compile a complete portfolio of all the research done on the artifact, the historical research, the material culture analysis, and then that will be given to the artists, and they use that as their inspiration as much as the actual visual look of the artifact.
So they won't be incorporating the artifact into the work of art. I'm sure that could be dangerous.
No, because it's a museum piece. Sure. If it wasn't, then they could, for sure. But because we've joined up with the Historical Society, we can't have them integrating that particular piece, but they might find another one at the many, many antique places around La Crosse.
Good point. So, I mean, I'm sure you've all had different ideas floating in your heads as to ways that artists could interpret this. Ariel, have you had any of your own ideas?
Yeah, so one of the original ideas that Amanda and Mathis and I had that we included in our first presentation was taking either the wedding dress or the Leona and pairing it with maybe like a metalwork specialist. We found an artist who actually had done this incredible, incredible piece. It was very obviously like a dress, but it was made of all metal, and it was very modern. It was very raw. It was so cool. just so cool. And so I really like the idea of kind of mixing mediums, so not putting a textile specialist with another, or textile with a textile specialist, but, you know, maybe putting a textile with someone who deals in ceramics, or, you know, doing fun, interesting things that really could really play with, like, the textures of things.
Callie?
I read an article not too long ago about, I think it was actually a university, an art department who created paper 18th century French gowns, like these massive gowns, wow, just completely out of paper. And I thought that was the most interesting thing I'd ever seen.
So a paper artist with the wedding gown.
Yeah.
All right, check. Yeah. We're looking for a paper artist.
Yeah.
Ariel, do you have
a bookbinder, please?
Yeah, right.
Have you had ideas?
Have I had ideas?
Or have you left that up to the students?
The piece that Ariel was speaking about, mm-hmm, that metal piece, that was on the cover of a friend of mine's book. That artist, a piece of hers, it was a brassiere. Do you remember that? It was a gold brassiere. And that was a book about lingerie. Okay. So there's a woman who I really like who works in oil with oil barrels, and she'll carve things out of oil barrels. So originally, this is kind of, so when Ariel and I had originally, and her group, right, had originally spoken about, like, how can we make this really interesting? How we can we make this go? Before I even got here, I started developing a class on 10 objects that changed the world. Mm-hmm. And I had an idea to do a similar thing at the Pump House, where we would have the podcast that the students have been creating over time on this project, and then have artists respond. So those oil barrels, that oil barrel art was really interesting to me, because oil is one of the objects that changed the world, mm-hmm, right? And so that's kind of where I was thinking, and that doesn't really relate to what we're doing. Although there is some history of oil here. So now I'm thinking.
Well, it's interesting because there are endless possibilities, mm-hmm, obviously, with art, and just it must be so interesting, the ideas that will be coming out of this.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I'm really looking forward to as the PR manager. I've already got ourselves an Instagram account, and Twitter, obviously, and Facebook. But I'm really excited about the Instagram opportunities. One of the things I'm hoping to do, and it's something that we're going to obviously have to coordinate with the artist, is to actually travel to their studios while they're creating, mm-hmm, and take kind of sneak peeks and show, you know, be able to kind of visit with them and see, okay, so you got the wedding dress. What are you doing? You know, like, what are you thinking? What's your process? So I really want to also kind of incorporate some of that into it as well.
Is it important to involve the public in that behind the scenes process when it comes to something like this? I mean, does it get people engaged or excited about it a little more?
Well, Ariel? We like to do that, of course.
Yeah.
So we're always interested in incorporating the public into the work that we're doing. Not only as, like, we're doing history for the public, we're doing history with the public in this case, right? And in all the cases, we try and do that more and more. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we're thinking about for the education to, again, involve, mm-hmm, involve the public. So we'll have the students and the artists presenting together, you know, maybe three student-artist combinations at a time at the Pump House, where they will give kind of an artist history talk together, you know, and the public can come to that and ask questions and so on. But there's the public, which is the students, and then there's the public that's the art, and, mm-hmm, then there's the public that can be the audience. And how can the audience become move from the public and become someone who's interacting and representing the project or recreating the project again?
Yeah, Callie, Nimi, and I have had a couple ideas with the education aspect, because we want to include local students. We're kind of thinking, like, part of the curriculum we'll develop is, like, you know, we don't want to have to develop a curriculum for every single age group, but we're thinking, you know, do a couple kind of steps, and then within that have assignments that they could, that'll be much more age appropriate. So, like, maybe with third graders, they'll come through and we'll have them go home and find, you know, look at an old piano, and they get to do an art project with it. Or, you know, an eighth grader might have to invest, you know, do like a book report or something like that. So I'm wondering if maybe we could almost do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Is there anything else that the three of you would like to talk about, Ariel?
I guess just especially because right now we're looking for call to artists. Please, if you're somewhat interested, the submission fee is only $15, which is extremely reasonable. That's one of the reasons why we did that is we want students, we want anybody to be able to apply to be in it. We're looking for all different types of mediums except performance art. But seriously, all different types of mediums. We are as interested in all the crazy, wacky, cool things that you can do. And we fully believe that you can do stuff with the artifacts that we'll give you.
Ariel Bougeau is a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of History and Co-Director of Artifact. Ariel Raker is Co-Director and PR Manager. And Callie O'Connor is Curator. Both Ariel Raker and Callie O'Connor are also UW La Crosse students. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. You can find a link to Artifact's website at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has links to this show and other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share your comments and or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.